This is Fresh Air. Yesterday, the legal system moved a step closer to recognizing the legitimacy of gay and lesbian relationships. A Minnesota appeals court granted guardianship of 35-year-old Sharon Kowalski to her lesbian lover, Karen Thompson. The case dates back to 1983, when Kowalski was in a car accident that left her nearly paralyzed with short-term memory loss and impaired speech. Her lover, Karen Thompson, wanted to be Kowalski's guardian, but Kowalski's parents objected. They said their daughter never told them she was a lesbian. Sharon Kowalski's father was appointed caretaker by a district court in Minnesota, and he barred Thompson from visiting his daughter for several years. Last year, the father resigned his guardianship, and the judge appointed a third party to take care of Kowalski. Yesterday, that decision was overturned by a Minnesota Court of Appeals. The judge said that all the medical testimony established that Sharon Kowalski has the capacity to express a preference in this case, and she has clearly chosen to return home with Thompson. William Rubenstein is the director of the ACLU's Lesbian and Gay Rights Project. I asked him about the significance of this decision.
The importance of the court's decision in the Kowalski case may in some larger picture be more, it may be more important as a societal matter than as a legal matter. As a legal matter, it sets a precedent that a lesbian or gay partner can be and in fact should be appointed to be the guardian of their partner in these kinds of circumstances. But it is an intermediate appellate decision from a Minnesota court, so the legal stature of it nationwide is somewhat, it's not a United States Supreme Court decision. Nonetheless, it's the first decision of its kind like this, so it's very important in that sense. And it clearly lays out all of the reasons that a lesbian or gay partner should be recognized as a guardian where they've taken care of their partner and are clearly the best person to do it. So it's a very good opinion, and it's a very well-written opinion, and it will be authoritative in that it's the first written opinion of its kind on this issue. But I think the decision coming as it does has a larger significance than its legal significance. I think societally it's a terribly important decision because it overcomes years and years of homophobia in the court system and recognizes the reality of lesbian and gay family life for the first time in this case.
I think there's something of a catch-22 in lesbian and gay relationships. Certain rights that spouses would have, lesbian and gays don't have because they're not married. On the other hand, the state doesn't allow them to get married.
Yeah, that's completely correct. I mean, lesbian and gay relationships, I mean, you kind of were caught coming and going. On the one hand, we're not permitted to get married, so that all of the rights that go with marriage, all of the kind of automatic things that flow from being married, do not go to lesbian and gay relationships, and we kind of have to fight for each one of them on a case-by-case basis. Then when we go into court to fight for them, the first thing that people say is, well, you're not married. The fact of the matter is we can't get married. So it is somewhat of a catch-22 situation. I think that people tend to overlook how much of our society is built around the rights that follow from a marriage, and that when you don't have the legal right to get married, how many benefits are denied to you. The importance of the Kowalski case, in some sense, is that it highlighted a very good example and a tragic example of why we need legal recognition for lesbian and gay relationships. Had Sharon and Karen been married, or had they been a married couple, their right to have this guardianship appointment would have been automatic. There wouldn't have been this 8-year struggle, 7 years in the Minnesota court system. I mean, 7 years in the court system fighting simply for the right to take care of one another and have that right recognized by law, where if they had been a heterosexual couple or a married couple, it would have been automatic in that sense. I think that there's perhaps no better example of the reasons that lesbian and gay relationships need to be recognized by the law.
Now, Thompson and Kowalski had exchanged rings at a commitment ceremony. Do the courts recognize that at all?
Well, again, with regard to fighting for lesbian and gay relationships, you're kind of put in a case-by-case basis of going into court in different kinds of circumstances and arguing about whether the relationship should be recognized or not. And when you're in front of a judge arguing about whether the relationship should be recognized or not, anything that you can point to that is kind of objective evidence of the relationship is very, very helpful. So in this case, the fact that they had exchanged rings, the fact that they had recognized each other as insurance beneficiaries were both recognized by the court. The court took notice of those facts as proving the existence of this relationship. And without any other mechanism to prove it, these kind of extrajudicial mechanisms become very important. We did a case here in New York State that went to the highest court in New York, the New York Court of Appeals, the Brashi case, which involved the right of a surviving partner to remain in a rent-controlled apartment. And family members were allowed to remain in rent-controlled apartments, and we had to prove that a gay man was a family member of his lover who had died. And similarly, in that case, we had to put in front of the court all the indicia of family to show that these two men were really a family of one another. And they included these kind of things, exchanging rings, shared bank accounts, family photographs, holding themselves out to a family. So in each case, there's an incredible burden of going in on a case-by-case basis and putting forward all of the facts of your existence. And, you know, as a lawyer, you hope that your clients have these facts to show. But oftentimes they don't. And particularly, I think, lower-income and lower-middle-income people may not have the kind of objective criteria that courts are most comfortable with, things like shared bank accounts or credit cards.
My guest is William Rubenstein, the director of the ACLU's Lesbian and Gay Rights Project. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is William Rubenstein, who directs the ACLU's Gay and Lesbian Rights Project. One of the complications for a lot of gays and lesbians who are involved in long-term relationships with somebody is that the parents of one of the two might really oppose the sexual orientation. And I think this was an issue in the Kowalski case. Kowalski's father didn't approve of the lesbian relationship, and when he had temporarily won custody, won guardianship of Kowalski, he prohibited Kowalski's lover from even visiting her.
Yeah, that's entirely correct. I mean, really, what the Kowalski case comes down to is the fight between between Sharon's partner in her lesbian relationship and her natural family. And I think what this exemplifies is kind of the extremes to which a natural family might go to try to deny the fact that their daughter was a lesbian and was in this kind of relationship. It's really an extraordinarily extreme case in that sense. Not only that Mr. Kowalski, you know, has fought in the court system for so long, but that, as you point out, at a certain point in the case, he absolutely cut off all visitation between Sharon and Karen, which is really rather extraordinary. Again, this resonates for a lot of gay people with the AIDS crisis as well. Well, this has come up more often in the 80s probably than any time before. With so many gay men dying of AIDS, a lot of their partners are often in disputes, or sometimes in disputes with surviving family members, over issues that range from who might take money from the estate to something quite simple like who's going to take care of the funeral and where are the remains going to be buried. You know, I've heard incredibly horrific stories about a dead gay man's partner fighting with his natural family about the very remains of the body itself.
Why did it take 7 years in the legal system for this case to be resolved?
This case essentially was resolved early in the 80s. If you look at it in terms of the resolution to the Kowalski family, the important thing about this case is that Karen never gave up, that she continued fighting for 8 years. And really what she's been fighting for 8 years is the homophobia of our society, in particular the homophobia and the failure to recognize lesbian and gay relationships by the Minnesota court system. You know, what's amazing about this case is that Karen persisted over those 8 years and kept going back and going back and going back and finding ways. I mean, one of the really, really amazing things to me about this case is so often you hear people in our society belittle lesbian and gay relationships. And I think if you look at what Karen's done for the last 8 years to win the right to take care of her permanently disabled partner, I don't think there's a better testament to what a relationship is or what a lesbian and gay relationship can be than what Karen Thompson has been doing for 8 years. It's really extremely extraordinary.
Karen Thompson won on the appellate appeal. Now, for the next person who's in a gay or lesbian relationship and who, you know, has gone through the commitment ceremony and the ring and everything, and who wants the same kind of rights that Karen Thompson won in the appeal, will they have to take it to the courts too, and will the appeal necessarily apply? I mean, will this precedent necessarily apply?
Yeah, good question. Guardianships can be appointed in any number of ways, and if they're not contested, they often don't have to go through the court system in quite this way. If they won't end up being a legal battle unless they arise in the context of a contest like this one between the natural family and the lesbian or gay partner. If they arise in that context in Minnesota, this case would be a direct precedent that you could cite and would probably be controlling, or you could argue that it would be controlling. So it's very important in that sense. If they arise in the context of a contest in another state, this Minnesota decision wouldn't necessarily be controlling, but it would be very persuasive precedent that you could argue about in any other state and hold up as good precedent.
You know, for anybody who's in a long-term relationship, would you advise a commitment ceremony and exchanging rings? So if there is in the future a guardianship type of question, there will be some kind of tangible evidence that you could present in court to prove your commitment to each other.
I think actually that the ceremony question is a very personal one. I think anyone who's in a relationship has to decide whether they would want to have a ceremony or exchange rings or have some kind of religious ceremony or whatever based on their own personal beliefs. I think if people are not, for instance, comfortable with ceremony and that's not the route that they want to go, they can execute legal documents that would have the same effect, the same kind of argumentative effect if they were ever to end up in court in this type of situation.
What kind of legal documents?
Well, for instance, with respect to a guardianship, you can execute either a power of attorney or a living will, the same kind of legal documents anyone else would execute. You can execute them while you're healthy and designate someone either to take care of you in this situation if this kind of thing happens or to make decisions for you if you're incapable of making them. And, you know, generally speaking, those documents, if they're properly executed at a time when you're of sound mind and body, will be followed by the court system. It is true that the courts may be loath to follow them if you've designated a lesbian or gay partner to take those to make those decisions for you or to take care of you. But by and large, the existence of a good written binding document like that will hold up in court in today's world in most places.
Do you think that homophobia within the judicial system has been a barrier to getting civil liberties for gays and lesbians?
I think homophobia in the judicial system is an enormous barrier to lesbian and gay rights every single day. I think in almost every area in which we fight for our rights in the courts, we come up against it. You know, when you think about it, societal attitudes towards lesbians and gay men are changing, and to some extent, that's reflected in the judiciary. But judges are people themselves, and if you take a poll of the public and 60% like something or don't like something, chances are 60% of the judiciary like something or don't like something along the same lines. Judges are people, and despite our legal system's belief that we law is above men or women or whatever, it's not the case. The law is made by judges, and judges are people. And, you know, with the current federal judiciary, they're increasingly conservative people as well, so that the fight's even harder all the time. You know, I think you can go through different areas in the law and the current legal status of lesbians and gay men, and you can see what we're up against. There was a recent opinion in a military case in the District of Columbia involving Joe Steffen, who was kicked out of the Naval Academy just some few months before he was to graduate at the very top of his class. Kicked out solely on the basis of his homosexuality. And a federal district court judge in Washington, in an absolutely horrific decision, has recently upheld the military's right to kick Joe out in those circumstances and upheld the military's regulations, which prohibit lesbians and gay men from serving their country in the military. And, you know, I think Judge Gash's opinion in this case is a good example of what we're up against. He totally discounts the Equal Protection Clause applicability to lesbians and gay men, and basically the bottom line of his opinion is that the Constitution and the Equal Protection Clause are not out there to protect our rights.
So what are the other big civil liberties issues now on the gay and lesbian rights front?
Well, I as I said, I think that the emergence of family issues is really in some ways at the center of the lesbian and gay rights agenda and the fight for equal recognition of our relationships. Both in cases like the Kowalski case and also increasingly with benefits issues in the workplace. I think lesbians and gay men are increasingly fighting for equal benefits rights in the workplace. Second, I think the military issue continues to be near the top of the agenda. And more broadly, I think discriminatory policies beyond the military itself. There's still state governments which refuse to hire and fire lesbians and gay men and all kinds of policies that we're fighting both in the state and in third issue is, believe it or not, still sodomy laws, which are on the books still in half the states in the United States. And I think much of the lesbian and gay rights movement is also, of course, because of the AIDS crisis and other events geared toward fighting AIDS and in a larger picture toward fighting for health care benefits and access to health care for all people.
William Rubenstein is the director of the ACLU's Lesbian and Gay Rights Project. This is Fresh Air.